You're listening to Building the Game with Rob and Jason.
It's Building the Game with Jason and Rob. For tabletop game design, you really can't go wrong. Building the game, yeah, building the game.
Hello and welcome to... welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday. May 25th, 2015, and you're listening to episode 156.
I can't, sometimes you get good, sometimes you're able to get in good intros, and I like to stop that if I can.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
The biffed intro is one thing I can hold against you most of the time, so.
it's something that I'm proud of, is I often find new and exciting ways to mess up an intro.
Yeah.
It's kind of my favorite challenge.
I do the same with pitching, so it's okay.
Hey!
As evidenced by the last pitch I just did.
Yeah, imagine that. I'm Rob, that's Jason. We're doing this again.
Ho!
Man, don't know how that happened. So we're having a night. I'm
drinking beer again this week.
I'm not, you are.
Vanilla Java Porter from the Atwater Brewing Company.
You're a big fan of that, aren't you?
It was okay. I've had it before. I mean, I bought it because I needed it for my beer cap map.
Oh, got it.
But I already have that one in now because I bought two of each in case I jacked it up.
Yeah, you've had that thing for a couple of months and you're not really filling it out very much.
No. Because I bought a bunch of Michigan beer and then I opened one of each and then...
Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14... 14 cabs?
14 cabs. That should get a little better. I'm going to Mackinac in a couple weeks. So I'm going to try and get some.
I hope so.
A Peninsula beer out of that.
I hope so, because I'm a little disappointed in you.
That's all right.
I think you'd have the thing half full by now.
When are you not disappointed in me, Rob?
Well, that's a fair question.
Kind of like my parents.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
And my boss.
Yeah.
And everyone else.
Right. I mean, the world is disappointed in you. Even your dog.
I don't even care. The good news is, I don't care.
Hey, spoken like an American. We're recording this the week before it comes out, but I am super pumped about the new Mad Max movie.
Yeah, you are.
I cannot wait to see that, man. That looks BA.
It does. Like, somebody just tweeted that there were 27 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, yeah?
And it after 27 reviews, it has 100% fresh rating. That doesn't happen, man.
Yeah,
that's not normal. That is odd.
Yeah, I've not read any reviews. I mean, the trailers are enough for me to say...
No, I haven't
read...
I don't review reviews either, but I saw that.
Yeah.
Somebody actually posted that, and I was but wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm excited. I don't know if my wife will want to go see it. But I don't know. I'll go that one alone if she won't go with me.
I'll go with you.
Yeah, okay.
My wife's not going to want to see it either.
Okay.
Let's just skip work one day and go see. Be like, we got
I do kind of have a stomachache right now. Maybe I need to call in 3 days.
Conference we need to go to.
Yeah.
We'll see you later.
Oh, Jason and I had some beer. It was a bad batch, and we need to stay home from work today.
I'm going to talk about The Walking Dead for a minute.
Yeah.
It's not even about The Walking Dead. As much as it's about something that a lot of people don't think about with the apocalypse, at least I don't think about with that kind of setting.
That it's not likely to actually happen?
Well, there's that. But no, something that people don't really think. No, people don't think that because there's preppers that are ready for zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
If we have to have an apocalypse, I vote for the slow zombie apocalypse because I think I do very well in that. Mm-hmm. Fast zombies will eat me, but slow zombies... I think I could rock that out.
Hey, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here and I'm going to be a bit of a rebel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to survive the apocalypse. I like my life the way it is right now. And if it all comes crashing down around me, I'm out. Peace.
Deuces.
Yeah. So, but go on. What was your thought about The Walking Dead?
This is something super, super sad that occurred to me. Like, and it has to do with connectivity. There are times in the show when they get split up, right? Like split up, sort of like unintendedly split up. Not like, I'm going to go here, you're going to go here, we'll meet back in the middle.
It's like, oh no, zombies are attacking. Let's both run in different directions.
Right, and like they get far enough apart, and like when you see someone in that setting, like when you leave, like there is a chance you will never see that person again.
Yep.
And you could live 5 miles from them for the rest of your life and never know.
Sure.
And I mean, if you think of like the Old West, that wasn't the case, right? Even though they had lack of communication, or even in medieval times. I mean, they had lack of communication, but they also understood where people sent and had the ability to send messages, right?
Sure.
So, like, if I know you're from this village, I always know where I could theoretically find you if you're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that is one of the most terrifying things I can think of. Like, being with your family and being separated and then, like, never having a way to find them. Like, literally, mm-hmm. never having... Because, like, The Walking Dead, right, they're constantly moving around and, like, going all these vast places. And, like, 90% of their show takes place in Georgia. Like, it's not a very big state as states go.
No, like, sure.
And most of them, I mean, granted, it's sometimes they've gotten farther away from Georgia and stuff, but still, like, the first few seasons, like, they're moving around and they're missing each other and stuff, and they're in freaking Georgia the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a scary thought, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that you could be that disconnected from people. So, that's what keeps me up at night, Rob.
Yeah, worrying about the zombie apocalypse and being disconnected from your family. No, but just,
like, that thought, like, it's a very scary thought to me. Mm. You know what that thought feels like to me? The idea of, like, something else that keeps me up at night is the idea of being in a boat, like a life raft.
Yeah.
In the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Like, for me, that's my peace out moment. Mm-hmm. That's my, just cut it off, dude, because, like, I can't, like, that sounds so terrible to me. So, mostly because I'm terrified of being eaten by a shark, which I know is not likely to happen.
Pretty slim chance of it. Yeah.
But if I was stranded in the middle of the ocean, that chance does go up a bit.
But you're in a boat, right?
Well, a small, like, life raft.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
sharks don't...
What happens when I get flipped over?
Well, then you climb on top of the
raft. Jaws ate through a life raft.
Yeah, well, you're right. And that was basically a documentary.
Hey, if you ask the Discovery Channel, no, not the Discovery Channel.
Spielberg?
No, is that the Discovery Channel?
Shark Week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, basically, they would tell you that Jaws is a documentary.
Right.
Mega shark.
Oh, yeah. Right.
They do all that fake stuff.
Right. Well, mega shark versus giant octopus or something, you know.
But they do things like they had this voodoo croc or something like that, it was called. And so basically what they did was they interviewed scientists and they were like, so do you think that there are crocodiles in the, like, someplace? Like,
uh-huh.
And they're like, oh yeah, that, you know, I think that definitely is the case. You know, are there crocodiles in Lake Pontchartrain? I think it was like, absolutely there's crocodiles in Lake Pontchartrain. I mean, there's, of course there are. Yes. And then, like...
Is that the big lake in Florida?
No, that's in Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
But then they're like, so do you think the voodoo croc is in... It was actually a voodoo shark, I think. But, like, do you think the voodoo... Because it was, are there sharks in Lake Pontchartrain?
Oh,
they
okay.
said, yeah, absolutely there's sharks in Lake Pontchartrain. I mean, like, it's connected to the ocean.
Yeah, it's a saltwater lake?
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's connected enough because, like, sharks can live... Bull sharks, especially bull sharks, can live months in fresh water.
Oh, okay.
Like, they find them coming up the St. Lawrence Seaway sometimes because they can. You know?
I did not.
Bull sharks are nasty. They're smaller, but they really like to. They're very aggressive.
Mm.
There was that story back in, like, the 40s, maybe, or the 20s, even, where a bunch of people got killed over the course of a summer and along a river that was 50 to 100 miles inland.
Oh, wow. And it was bull sharks?
It was a bull shark. It was one bull shark.
One bull shark.
Just wrecking it.
Just one guy. Just one guy throws caution in the wind. He's like, I'm going for it, guys.
So they say to the guy.
His buddies dared him. Right. It was a college hazing thing that got out of control.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
They were like, they say to the people, so are there sharks in Lake Pontchartrain? And they're like, well, absolutely there are sharks in Lake Pontchartrain. Yeah, well, they say, absolutely. They're yes, definitely in Lake Pontchartrain, right? And then on the show, they say, do you believe the voodoo shark is in Lake Pontchartrain? And they're like, absolutely. Like, these people would say, they would ask me one question, and then when I see the show, they ask me a completely different question and tied it to that answer.
Yeah.
Like, that is so terrible. I mean, I get the Discovery Channel is not the, you know, best thing in journalism that ever happened.
Yeah, no. Far from it.
Yeah, but I mean,
as it turns out,
that is just so terrible that they could do that. I mean, because these people's careers they're messing with. I mean, like... If people are like, first of all, why are you on a Discovery Channel documentary? You should know better, for Shark Week, especially.
By now, you should know better, yeah.
Right, so.
10 years ago, I guess you could be forgiven, but.
Right, yeah, the first time they did, like, Octo Shark or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Octo Shark.
Megalodon.
Like a half octopus, half shark?
So like, they don't think megalodons, they say, don't exist anymore, right? That's not a question. I'm clear. I'm saying for the fact. I know that they say megalodons don't exist. But I'd like to point out the coelacanth. Do you feel me with the coelacanth?
That's everyone's argument.
No.
Anytime something like this comes up.
But it's a living fossil, right? Like, it's something that they thought for millions of years it was extinct.
Sure.
Turns out there's, like, a bunch of them running around, right?
Well, not a bunch, but they're out there.
they're pretty small though, right? So Megalodon, bit of a stretch. I'm just saying the ocean's big. How excited would you be? How excited would you be if you knew that Megalodon was real? He's not, but let's say he was.
Sure, that'd be cool.
That'd be exciting.
Well, I mean, Megalodon technically, I mean, Nessie, right?
No, that's a plesiosaur, dude.
Megalodon. Plesiosaur. Oh, you're right. I apologize. Plesiosaur. Yeah.
Yeah. Either way, not a Megalodon's a shark, dude.
Yeah.
Giant shark. There's a museum around here where they have the Megalodon mouth.
Oh, do they?
And it's like you can stand inside. I mean, it's enormous. But okay, so one more note here on this thing. Uh-huh. Something else that people thought were not real, were just legend. This is not an actual animal.
The chupacabra.
No, that's legend. But there's Bigfoot. There's documented evidence about
Bigfoot. Well, we all know about that. But no, we've talked about that ad nauseum.
Yeah, but no, on the show we have. Oh yeah, we have. Yeah, because it's been a while. Pitching games about Bigfoot.
I did twice,
like 100 times,
and neither
like
time did it actually
games.
Work.
Every games. No,
I
they were
still want to make a Bigfoot game,
but it's so elusive. It's like it doesn't exist.
It's exactly. You're right. You're right.
But no, Rogue Waves. Right, Rogue Waves. They thought Rogue Waves were like a fake thing. Mm-hmm. They were like, Rogue Waves are not real. They don't actually happen. Mm-hmm. And then, like, so they started getting more reliable hits. Like, no, dude, we got hit by this huge wall of water, right? So they put this satellite up. I can't remember what the name of the satellite was. It's still out there, but this put this satellite up, and it started scanning the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Rogue waves are, like, super common in certain points in the ocean. Like, they happen all the time. Mm-hmm. Isn't that crazy?
Hello, and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday. I don't know. We should talk about games for a
change. Why are you doing the intro?
Just trying to start over.
Don't start over.
It's Monday, so, May 25th, 2015, and you're listening.
You can't start over. That was
156.
You can't start over. That was a lot of time.
My name's Rob, and that's Jason. How's it going, Jason?
It's going good.
You been playing any games lately?
Nope.
All right.
We were talking about Megalodons and Rogue Waves.
Moving on, then.
Let's go to the feature of the week.
Boy.
When we first started to do that, I was nervous that we hadn't done the intro, but I was like, no, we did do the intro. You had me nervous.
Yeah.
You had me nervous. All right, so.
So, you haven't been playing anything. Let's talk about our feature.
I'm going to design a game about Rogue Waves.
Do that. And Megalodons and Bigfoot.
And Nessie.
And Coelacanth.
Coelacanth.
Yeah. Coelacanths are us.
If the coelacanth lives, so does the megalodon. I get it. That's like, that doesn't make any sense. So what is that called? What kind of fallacy is that? This would be the fallacy. Megalodon. We found, megalodon used to live.
Mm-hmm.
We found fossils. The coelacanth used to live. We found fossils. The coelacanth still lives. Therefore, the megalodon still lives.
That's hasty generalization.
That's what it is. Thank you. I couldn't remember. I know them all, but I can't always remember what they're called. So
yeah.
I know Slippery Slope. I know the Straw Man. You know, but yeah. So
that was actually one of my most favorite college classes that I ever took was the logic class.
Yeah, it's a good class.
It was
it
was like math with words. It's great. I loved it.
It's pretty sweet. Yeah. So. All right. So
anyway,
so
feature. Sorry, guys. I promise next week we'll get back to some more games.
They don't care. Feature of the week, though, is a board game topic. Mm-hmm. So Isaac Shalev said we should talk about writing rules.
He did.
And we like Isaac, and we haven't talked about writing rules in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I think we probably write rules very differently than we used to.
That's true.
So you're better at writing rules. So take it away, Rob.
Yeah, so obviously the challenge of writing rules is to make sure that anybody who comes along with a moderate level of intelligence can pick up your rules and the components for your game and play that game without any advice, without any guidance. And it's surprising how often that is not true for professionally printed rules.
It's shockingly not true.
It's a shame. And it makes me sad. And
when you think about it, though, it's difficult. Like, me describing a game to you is so much easier than you writing it down and me having to figure it out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Those two things could not be more different from each other. Because it's so much easier to just say, okay, now you take this many cards and everybody gets this many cards and then you roll a die and let's go. And then you just right. work people through it as they play. And you give them general overview of how things work. Mm-hmm. And then as specific things come up, you just explain them as needed, you know? And that's great and that's easy. But when it comes to the rules, you can't assume that you're going to be there or that right. somebody who already knows how to play the game is going to be there to help the guy who picked this up at the game store. So you need to make sure that every possible contingency is covered in the rules.
Right.
And that's what makes writing rules really hard and yeah. really time consuming and just pull your hair out frustrating.
So the number one tip I could give you about writing rules is write the rules and then have someone who's played your game read the rules and have mm-hmm. them tell you what they think and then make your tweaks and then take those same rules and give them to at least 2 to 3 people who have never played your game.
Mm-hmm.
And say, how do you play this game? And that is a lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if those people are like Neil Roberts and some others.
Yeah, maybe we should be asking Neil this question because he is like the number one rules editor right. that we know.
And he's really good at...
He's great.
He's really good at reading it and saying, this doesn't make sense because of this, mm-hmm. you know, and so...
Yeah, so how do you go about writing rules? So... I have started, and I'm not going to say that everybody should do it the way that I do it, but I'm going to tell you this is how I like to structure it for myself.
Okay.
Okay? And the end result does not always follow the same format. This is always the way I like to start.
Right.
Okay? I always like to start, first of all, by writing an introduction to the game.
This Absolutely.
Is probably some kind of a short paragraph, just to give somebody a setting in which to play the game, kind of explain the theme or introduce the theme to it. Okay.
And the style in which you write that, and I know you do this and so do I,
yeah.
should convey the tone of the game.
Absolutely.
So right. if it's a funny game, it should be funny.
Right.
If it's not a funny game, it should not be funny. Mm-hmm. If it's a sad, dark game, it should be sad and dark sounding. Right.
Or if it's kind of an abstract, puzzly sort of thing, then that introductory paragraph should be fairly technical.
Exactly.
I think it's extremely important that even if it's a short intro, a short limited intro, it should convey clearly to the reader the tone of the information to come and reflect the tone of the game itself.
And I hate reading game rules, but I always read that part of the game rules.
And that's exactly it. And somebody should be able to read that paragraph, that introductory paragraph, and say, I think I have an idea just from this of how I'm going to feel playing this game. Not right. how to play it, but how I'm going to feel while I'm playing it.
Which is almost just as important. And you yeah. should really, in my opinion, keep it 2 to 3 sentences max.
Yeah, real short is fine.
Because you're asking them to read something that has nothing to do with how to play the game.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, kudos to you if you want to write 10 pages of fiction. Put that at the end of the rule book.
Yes.
Yeah, put that at the end. Don't make them read that up front. Okay, so your first paragraph is introducing the theme, introducing the setting, introducing just the basic goal here of what you're doing. The next paragraph should introduce in some kind of basic summarized way the structure of the game. Okay?
Right.
So with Saloon Tycoon, the introductory paragraph is saying, hey, this is a gold rush town, it's an old west, it's wacky, whatever. Paragraph number 2 says, this game is played by building a three-dimensional structure on your table and strategizing what tiles to build at the right time so you can attract good guys and bad guys.
Right.
Which will gain you points. Okay.
So the second thing I always put in, I thought you did this too, was I always put a component list next.
Okay. I do the component list after that. And again, you know,
okay.
in the end, once everything's edited, that might get shifted around. Right. But this is the order in which I work these things.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
So, but yeah, I agree. A component list, I think, needs to be in there early.
And a component list is really helpful for you as a designer.
And that's why I put it in there.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's nice to have in there too, so people know, especially because you're like, the little meeple of what? And then you're mm-hmm. like, oh, there's 6 meeples in 4 colors, like mm-hmm. 4 of each. Like Epic Monster Tea Party would be a great example sure. of like,
right.
to list the colors of meeples and stuff in there. Cause then people are like, mm-hmm. oh, I get it. There's yeah. this many of this. Right. That makes sense.
Now in the end, you might move that component list to the end of the rules right. or, you know, whatever you decide
maybe
to do.
Maybe you have to get rid of it for some reason. But, sure. Yeah.
Or maybe it makes more sense later. But I like it that way because it helps me make sure that I've introduced these ideas, but it also helps me define terms.
Right.
And that's another thing that's super, super, super important when you're writing rules is defining terms and sticking with those terms in a consistent way.
Yeah, very important.
Okay. If you're going to say meeples, say meeples. If you're going to call them wooden person tokens, call them wooden person tokens.
First of all, get a better name. But
well, yeah, but but the point is, if you're going to pick a term, stick with that term.
Yes.
Be consistent. And this is a pet peeve of mine, but if you're going to capitalize that term, right, throughout the entire thing. And I think it's very important to be careful about what kinds of terms like that you choose, and that you capitalize them intelligently.
Yep.
Because people will notice capitalized words in the middle of a paragraph.
And I generally try and do that. Like if I have like action cards for a generic reason, mm-hmm, I would always say capital A, capital C for action cards. Like mm-hmm, every time.
Sure. Yep.
And that's just my style. Not everybody does it that way, but I do think capitalizing words is a great way to call out words so that mm-hmm, you know, hey, important word here. I've seen some rules, not a lot, but I've seen a couple different rules where they'll actually italicize those words mm-hmm, to even more get your attention, or bold those words.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that, but I think it's a nice touch, especially sure, in a game with a lot of heavy description.
Yeah.
I think that draws mm-hmm, to...
Right.
Okay, so what do you put next?
Well, so to extrapolate on defining words and things a little bit, I the example I use was meeples. What do you call a meeple? Call it a meeple. But it's also important that you're very, very clear when it comes to action words. So you just said action card. I want to think about words like draw.
Yep.
When you draw a card, don't use the term draw and the term take.
Right.
Interchangeably. If you're going to say draw, use draw consistently.
Right.
Another thing is with this monster battle games, the basic rules I've written up so far, sometimes you're going to draw a card and sometimes you're going to pull a cube from a bag. Right. And I want to make sure that I differentiate right, between those two actions using different words. And you could say those are the same word in practice.
But it's not.
But in reading it, it makes a huge right, difference.
And another good example of that in a published game is Dominion.
Yeah.
You could say discard a card,
mm-hmm,
but the difference between discard and trash is vastly different.
Very, very different. Right.
And the game example, will be not fun if you mix those two cards up.
Right. Right.
So it's important, you know.
Those kinds of little things right, are extremely important for readability, for clarity,
right,
for to reduce confusion. Okay.
Right.
So the next thing I do then is I like to introduce the goal of the game. As if to say, basically to say, here's how you win. Okay. In a basic style, I like to say, here's how you win the game. Here's what you're working towards at the end. And maybe that's as simple as, the winner of the game will be the person who gets the most points or has the most money.
Right.
Okay. And only then, after I've introduced the theme, introduced the structure, explained the basic goal and listed the components, only then do I get into game setup.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
And mine varies a little, but yeah.
Sure.
Basically the same thing.
Okay. So game setup. So then game setup is what are you doing? You're shuffling cards, you're dealing things out. How do you set up the board? All that sort of thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is also actually a good opportunity for you to try and identify your he or she sort of pronouns. And,
right.
And that's a kind of thing that a lot of people have argued about. Should you say, should everything be he? Should you assume the player is a he, or should you assume the player is a she, or should you use these things interchangeably? I think the worst thing you can do is use these terms interchangeably.
Yeah, I think if you're in one section, you need to use he or she, not both.
Yeah.
Or I try and stick with terms like the player rather than using pronouns. Only because then I don't have to worry about, did I say he or she there?
Yeah. And that's another thing. I try and use the player in a generic sense when I'm explaining general actions. But if I'm using a specific gameplay example, then I revert to pronouns because then I'm talking about one specific person, not the general player.
That's fair.
Okay. And then if you're going to do that, that's fine. Especially if you're giving an example of two or three players, then with all of your examples, you want to be consistent with those pronouns. Player right, one is always a he, player two is always a she.
Right.
Okay.
Another thing you can do in there is give them names. Some things do
also
that.
A good option.
Tommy, right, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Gina, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. So that's another great, great way to approach that. Okay. So in your setup, it's a good way. If you want to use pronouns, this is a good time to introduce pronouns and just get that out of the way. And I mean, realistically, I think too many people worry about that too much. That's my own personal opinion. But at any rate.
Right.
Game setup, you want to make sure that you list that out very, very clearly. And you should list in that game setup what you do with each component in the same order that they are listed in your components list.
Yep.
Okay. make sure that you're in that criminal list. In this case, you're defining, if there are multiple decks or multiple card types, that you're identifying the action deck, the item deck.
And so in-game setup or slightly before game setup, I'll do this in certain games. I did this in Water Balloon Washout because I knew it was going to be a game played by non-gamery people a lot of times. And I wanted to be very clear because there are some gamery things about the game. So I actually defined action cards, and then action cards were water cards, utility cards, and defense cards. And I actually had a little two lines about each one of those to tell you the idea of what those games do. And I included that right before game setup. So what is the last thing that should be said in game setup in every single game ever?
The last thing that should
be
said?
The very last thing.
Determining who goes first?
Exactly.
Okay.
So because that does not go in gameplay.
Right.
Because gameplay should assume I should be able on gameplay read every single turn that should be applicable.
Yeah.
It should not be first turn and then after. As much as possible, game setup and gameplay. Gameplay is what I do every single turn. So
yeah, I agree with that.
It's a pet peeve of mine. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, when they decide who goes first later.
And
yeah.
I like that I can just glance down at the bottom of game setup right before the gameplay thing and say, boom, that's who goes first. And then it flows right into, hey, after you know who goes first, now here's how you play the game.
Sure. Good. Okay. Now, in terms of gameplay, that can be tricky. And a lot of that is going to depend on how complicated your game is to play.
Yeah, that's the hardest part.
I have a few games in my collection that I've never played because I couldn't get through the gameplay section because it was written so terribly, or in a couple of cases, it was translated from German so terribly that I just have no idea what's going on. And that's really frustrating. So, I like to think about the anatomy of a turn. What am I going to do on my turn? You know, and then you should break that down. What your options are within that turn, you should break that down in the order that they could potentially happen. Now, that said, I don't, and I hate this. I hate it when this gameplay section then goes into every possible permutation of what you could do.
Oh, that's the worst.
Okay, that's for clarification in a later section. Okay, the gameplay section should be telling me what actions am I going to take. It should not be explaining how different cards interact with each other and the results of different actions combining. I don't want to hear that right now.
Right.
I just want to know what are my options on this turn.
Right.
Okay.
Something that's good in the gameplay section or in any section is if you've got something you want to get people's attention on, I will do like star and then in capital letters and bold the word note.
Sure.
And then put after that.
Yeah.
Like, and that's for those things that like might trip people up or, you know, those are the type of things where you're like, gosh, how do you... What was this? Oh, right there. Note. Okay,
sure.
That's it.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point. And another benefit to doing to having a call out like that, it's a way for people to say, oh, I got to remember that. But it's also something people can kind of subconsciously go, this is my first read through. I'm going to skip that this time and just focus on the actions.
Right.
Which is really, really beneficial.
Right.
Now, this is something, this next thing and this is something I do a lot that I've gotten criticism for from Neil, but from other people.
Neil.
Is repeating the same thing. Now, I do that. I don't necessarily repeat the same thing twice in a row, but I might say something in early in the rule book that says, and you can do this, but I might say that option again later on when I think it might be pertinent.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, I've gotten criticism from people for that because they say that the rules should be lean and direct and to the point and should not have any extraneous information in them. And you know, and there's a legitimate argument to be made for that.
I think it just depends on the complexity of the rules.
That's the thing. And from my point of view, things that playtesters forget about. And so if there's a thing that I feel like is an important aspect of the game for people to remember that in playtesting I've seen people forget, I'm probably going to mention two, and depending on the severity of it, maybe even three times.
Right.
Just to drive home to somebody that this is easy to forget, but it really is important.
Another thing I want to note here in the gameplay, so like if a game is complex and you have lots of different stages in your turn, like in a round, this happens, and it's like 12 things happen. Do two things. One, make sure to give bold titles to each of those sections.
Mm-hmm.
And two, have a card that has that listed on there. If that's at all complicated, because one of the worst things is, and I used to have this trouble with Ramblers, but we cleaned it up so that it's not, so that it's a lot simpler, like in the rounds. But like when I first in a Ramblers, the hardest thing, and we talked about this, was always remembering to do X.
Yeah.
oh, we forgot to do this. Oh, we forgot to do that. That doesn't happen anymore because we've streamlined the game. But like that, I've seen that happen in a lot of games.
Sure. Yeah,
like, oh, we forgot to do blah. So turn order cards, supplement to the rules for actual during gameplay.
Yeah.
Can make a difference if the turn order is very complex.
Yeah. And those are typically upkeep kinds of things, which are notoriously difficult by nature to remember. Right. Yeah. And that can be tough, you know? I mean, Saloon Tycoon has a little bit of that in that we're just frankly remembering to collect your gold at the start of every turn, you know?
See, and I never have trouble with that because that is an active thing that's going to make my turn better.
Mm-hmm.
What I forget is at the end of your turn, do blah. That will have no effect until next turn.
Sure.
That I have trouble remembering.
Yeah.
You know?
Ticket to Ride, I'm guilty of that. I forget to score points. Because we're so excited about, you know, drawing the next card and laying down cars and things that Christine and I always, we just forget to keep track of how many points that we've scored. Now, the nice thing about Ticket to Ride is that you can still tally them all up, all the points at the end of the game. Right. But we lose that aspect of paying attention to where each other are in the score.
Right.
You know, so we do lose something in that. But at any rate, So from the rest of the way there with the gameplay section, you just kind of have to be detailed and specific, and take a player through what they're going to do on their turn. And then, like I said, after the gameplay is where you get into all the possible potential permutations and specific exceptions examples. And specific examples. Right. Yeah. I prefer a rule book that just gets me through the how to play the game. And you know what? Actually, the Dominion rulebook is very good about that. They actually have two different rulebooks in the version that I have. One is like a short page and a half thing that says, this is how you play the game. And then the next thing is like a 6-page booklet that gets you through all kinds of potential combos and detailed stuff.
That's cool.
Which I appreciate that a lot.
I'll probably never read the longer rulebook, but that's cool.
I don't think
you might reference it, right?
Yeah, here and there. Yeah.
So something else that I do that some people have told me is not necessary. And it depends on the type of game, but like sometimes I will call out strategies in the game.
Okay.
I only do it if I really think it's something that's going to be overlooked. You know what I mean? Like, but I've done it in a couple of games. I can't remember what they are, but, you know, and I don't think I purposely call them out as like a strategy to win could be this. It's just like pointing out that you can do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Sandbox Showdown might be one of them because it like,
sounds likely.
Because people wouldn't think about, duh, I could just do that. And so we'd be playing and I would do it and be like, oh, you can do that? I didn't realize it. So I try in the rules to make sure to call that stuff out and say, hey, FYI, here's some tricks you can use for winning.
Yeah. And you know, and that's the kind of thing that I'll definitely need to do if this Monster Battles game gets to that point of writing rules. You know, I'll want to make sure that I at least explain how the different monster decks work and how they're themed and what their goals are.
Because you explained that to me ahead of time. I didn't listen, which is why I lost. But but it did help to know that, oh, I'm going for darkness and then blood.
Yeah, right. So those kinds of things are important. Okay, so you work through your gameplay, you work through your exceptions and your detailed explanations, and now you're through your gameplay. Now I like to come back to how to win. Okay, so winning the game. So I already said early on, this is how you win the game. But now the reader, the player, has a whole lot more information about how to achieve that goal. And so now I'm going to give them a more detailed explanation of how they're going to win or what their goal is in order to win.
And I usually pair this and call this section either game end and scoring or game end and winning.
Sure.
And that will so that's basically like, this is what triggers the game end. And this is how you decide who won.
Sure. Yeah. It's you need some kind of clear label like that to say, this is a new section, and this is what this new section is about, and it is very direct and very clear what that is about. Right. I agree with that 100%. That's how I approach writing rules at this point. And I'm not saying that my way is the best way, but it's so far, right now, it's working for me.
Right. No, and it works for me too. You and I have pretty much the same process for it.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we've worked together on rules before and we've read each other's rules so many times that it's kind of like, oh, Rob does that works for him. Or, oh, Jason does it that way. And that seems good. So like we just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's no substitute for having other people read your rules and commenting on them and don't be too precious with them. Like any of this stuff that we do here, you cannot be too precious. You have to be willing to change and adapt because something that can be terribly obvious to you is very likely not because you can't make any assumptions.
Yeah.
So
So yeah, that was not a super long topic, but that was pretty dense with stuff. So I hope we're good to move on.
Yeah, and of course, as always, we're curious to hear other people's opinions.
Yeah,
you know, do you guys have any different approaches?
A lot of people do different ways. I'll tell you, it is astounding to me how many good published games have really crappy rules.
Such terrible rules. Oh man, it's maddening.
Right,
it's maddening.
One of the companies that I always say, at least for the two games of theirs I played, is Rather Dashing Games. Like both Four Taverns and Dwarven Miner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I hate reading rules, but I read their rules and I'm like, I get it. So, and Grant, he said they work very hard on those to try to make sure that they're. But, mm-hmm. but like, that's a company where I'm like, dang. Good job writing rules sure. that like I because like I'm terrible at reading rules and understanding them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I just think differently than that. Sure. So most of the time I try and get you to read the rules because you're good at reading the rules and regurgitating how to play. So
yeah, the one that keeps springing to my mind that I just absolutely despise, it's that two player Catan card game that I have. Gosh, I can't remember what the name of it is now, but it's a two player version of Catan that's just all cards. And Christina and I have sat down to try to play that game, I think now, five times. And all five times, I mean, it's like six pages of setting up the game.
Ugh, that's terrible.
And then the rules are another six or eight pages.
Just play the Catan dice game. It's not anything amazing, yeah. but like, it's like, how do I play this? Oh, there's like a page of rules. Done. Got it. Yeah. This is really easy.
Yeah.
Do this.
And this one, it's like, by the time we get halfway through the gameplay section, I'm just pissed off. And I just like this. I don't care. This could be the most fun game in the world, and I bet it is. But I just don't care. I have no interest in playing this now. It's like when we were trying to do that thing with the runes the other day, and there was an 80-page little book about a booklet about how to read the runes. And it's like, nope, never gonna happen.
Right.
You know, don't care.
So you should pitch a game because we're running short on time.
Okay, I'll do that. We were talking about. Reality Shark Week stuff. One of the best reality shows that I've been watching lately is a show. I think it's probably a History Channel show, but I've been watching it on Netflix. It's called America's Book of Secrets. And it's about all kinds of it's about all kinds of
fake things that aren't true.
They do interesting stuff, like inside the White House and just about the operations of the White House, or inside the Secret Service, and it's stuff like that. But they did an episode on Fort Knox.
Yes,
about Fort Knox and its history and all the mysteries about Fort Knox, and I'd never heard so much about Fort Knox before, and I found it very fascinating. And I would say the episodes of that show, it's about 50% nonsense and garbage and roll your eyes. Well,
I mean, they are though. I mean, those shows, they're trying to make you be like, whoa,
right?
They're playing to the conspiracy people.
Yeah, but 50% of it actually is some interesting modern American history that I don't necessarily know.
Awesome.
And so I kind of enjoy that. So, and that got me thinking, Fort Knox, I feel like it hasn't really been in the public eye in a while. And I wondered if I could do something with Fort Knox. Now the cool thing is that back in the 70s, because I guess there was a lot of controversy back in the 60s and 70s about American gold reserves. So at some point in the 70s, the government, some senator, I think it was, decided to take a news crew or a group of news crews into Fort Knox and open one of the vaults and show people, look, there actually is gold in here. Fort Knox is not empty.
Wow.
And it was the first time the public had ever seen inside Fort Knox. And it turned out that there were 13 vaults inside Fort Knox. Each of those vaults, I wrote it down here, each of those vaults holds 1.2 million troy ounces of 99.999% pure gold.
Wow.
Yeah. And some of the conspiracy theorists say, if the total American gold reserves in Fort Knox are what they claim to be, then there's got to be more vaults underground below those 13 vaults. But these are the ones they were willing to show. So what are they really hiding? Ooh, whatever. Oh,
gosh.
Okay, so 13 vaults. And I thought, well, hey, 13 vaults, that's... Sure, that's a good start for a game.
Yeah,
13 vaults. Okay, it's a game about Fort Knox. So what do you have to do in a game about Fort Knox?
Steal the gold.
Yeah, well, you have to steal. You have to rob.
You have to call this game 13 vaults, not Fort Knox.
Oh, you think so?
Yes, 13 vaults.
Fort Knox : 13 vaults.
13 vaults, robbing Fort Knox. Something like that.
That's better.
Yeah, that's 13 volts. It's just it's interesting. Like, 13 volts. What?
Yeah.
Fort Knox. I'm like, meh. Fort Knox.
Right. So
meh, as they say on the internet.
Yeah, meh. That's a Simpsons word.
But they say it on the internet a lot.
They do. Yeah. Simpsons originated that though. Meh.
Good for the Simpsons.
That came from
don't meh.
That came from Homer. Anyway, so 13 volts. Okay, so the players are. I'm also operating on the assumption here that everyone who works at Fort Knox is secretly working for some crime syndicate.
Why not?
You know, because, I mean, duh, right?
Conspiracy.
Because everyone who's working there thinks that they're the only one who's working for some evil crime syndicate is looking for some way to rob Fort Knox.
Great.
And they don't really know that everyone around them also is a bad guy. So they're all pretending to be nice guys, good guys. There probably are a few self-righteous, you know, actual true honest people working there, but for the most part, they're all crooks. That's the assumption of this game. So all the players are employees of Fort Knox who are responsible for maintaining and inventorying and cleaning these vaults. And they're all trying to steal something.
Yeah.
Or steal a group of things. Because there's all kinds of things hidden in Fort Knox. There's gold. Did you know the Declaration of Independence was there for several years?
Yep.
Yep. The Constitution also.
Yep.
There was a period of time when the Magna Carta was hidden in Fort Knox.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah. And of course, alien wreckage. Apparently during World War II,
everybody knows there's the alien wreckage there.
Oh yeah. Well, it's everywhere really. During World War II, there were stockpiles of morphine and opium because they feared, drug shortages.
I doubt that's true.
No, it's absolutely true.
Really?
Yeah. That's absolutely true. Wow. Yeah. And I guess, over time it's been, a kind of a place where different, monarchies around the world have asked the U.S. to keep safe crown jewels and things for their countries while those countries were in times of upheaval and they were concerned about getting robbed and things getting stolen.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
So we're like, we're going to go ahead and keep those guys. Thanks.
Right. Yeah. And some of that is rumor and some of that has been admitted like by the government. Like, yeah, of course. Yeah. We had that stuff there.
I could see England being like, hey guys, you hold the stuff for us. And we're like, yeah, no problem.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't necessarily think it was the British crown jewels, but theoretically.
I'm just saying, but a country like that, I don't think Russia's going to be like, hey.
Oh, well, yeah, right. U.S. friendly countries. Yeah, okay, so 13 vaults. So the 13 vaults are represented by 13 envelopes, okay? 13 envelopes, similar to the envelope in Clue. But in this case, these envelopes have printing on both sides. One is just a standard, it's a vault, you know, and it's got a number on it, and they're number 1 through 13. The other side is the same thing, but it has the word lockdown stamped on it, okay? So, and then there are 39 item cards, okay? And each of these is some unique item of something that is secreted away in Fort Knox. At the start of the game, you shuffle up these 39 cards, and you put 3 cards into each envelope at random. No one knows what goes in there. Then each player gets a kind of an order, okay, from their own crime syndicate, and that order has 3 items on it that they need to steal from Fort Knox.
Yep.
Okay? And everybody's going to have a different combo. There could be some overlap in some of these, but everybody's got a different combo. And I think realistically, actually, it might not necessarily be 39 unique items. Like, there's probably 10...
Multiples are gold.
Yeah, you know, like 8 or 10 gold things, you know, and
different values of gold.
Six or eight jewels and some unique. So there's going to be some overlap.
So one person's order could just be at least X amount of gold.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get multiple amounts of gold in the
exactly.
same one.
Right, exactly. So at any given time, of course, everything's locked up in these vaults. But what players need to do is, because they're doing inventory and they're cleaning the vaults, occasionally, and actually once per turn, they're going to need to...
Shuffle.
Somebody is going to need to open a vault, okay? And so these 13 vaults are arranged around the board, okay? And then there's an open area in the center, which is kind of the holding area, okay? And so periodically, once per turn, somebody is going to open a vault, and they're going to take the cards out of that vault, that envelope, and put those cards in this open area. Okay. And this is where they're being inventoried while the vault's right. being cleaned. Okay. Now the open area, can have up to 6 items in it at a time.
Okay.
Okay. And now I'm going to go back to my notes to make sure I get this right. So your goal is to arrange the cards and envelopes so that you can have your specific 3, the 3 items you're looking for, in the open holding area in the center of the table at the same time, so your bad guy crew can come in and steal them. All right. On each turn, every player can take an inspect action. That means they can place their pawn on one envelope if it is not on lockdown. Then they have the option to use their special power if they want. Every player has a special power. After each player has inspected, player one can choose any envelope, including one on lockdown, to open and lay the cards face up in the holding room. Then he can move those cards so everybody can see what those cards are. Then player one can move those cards to any other one envelope he wants, but no more than five cards in a single envelope.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right? Okay, so you've got, you open one, you put those three cards out there. You can only move two of those cards back to one envelope, and you can't split them between two envelopes. You can put them back in one.
Right, because you're picking them up, moving them back to a right. vault.
So you're going to leave one card in the open area for the right. next round. Okay. Then that's the end of the round, and play passes to the next person. So only one player on a round is going to be opening a vault and moving cards around, except for their special powers.
Right.
All right. And then next round, player two is going to be the guy who opens a vault and moves right. stuff around like that.
So you're thinking up to four players?
I'm thinking three to six.
Okay. Quick question.
Yeah.
One. How? What makes the vault go on lockdown?
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay.
And two, the order cards, are they going to have some of the same things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not all like, I'm the only person that needs the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Okay. Because that would suck. Because
yeah.
then like, I keep putting it there and some jerk keeps taking it away.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mentioned special powers, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Each player has a special power that they can use during the inspect phase. So the first part of each round is where everybody can inspect stuff. In order to use it, they have to put their card face up next to a spinner, which identifies which section of the fort is being searched by the guards. So this is a game with a spinner. Okay.
Oh, a spinner!
And the guards are these self-righteous guys, the few only honest people actually working at right. Fort Knox. Okay. At the start of the open or move phase, that's when somebody actually moves stuff around, the main player must spin the spinner to see where the guards will be. If the spinner stops on your card, the envelope your pawn is on will flip to the lockdown side.
Okay.
There are also two all clear spaces, which will flip all of the envelopes back to the normal side. So you have to choose when you're going to use your special power. You have to choose where you're going to place your card on that spinner.
So if they catch you in lockdown, you're stuck in the vault.
Well, you can't do anything with that vault. Okay. That vault is locked down. That vault is basically cut off to everybody.
I'm checking out vault four, and then boom, vault four comes up. You're like, well, crap.
Right.
I'm just wasted my turn.
Exactly.
Cool.
Okay. So what are the special abilities? Okay. Examples like you can look at the contents of two additional envelopes, not just one, but two additional up to three.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Another one. You can swap a card from an envelope you look at with one in the open holding area.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at the contents of one additional envelope and swap a card from one with a card from another one. Okay. Without looking at the cards, shuffle the contents of three envelopes together and deal them back out to their envelopes.
That just sounds like a screw you guy.
Yeah. You can flip an envelope to the lockdown side or vice versa, or you can look at another player's theft card and swap with them if you want to. Okay. These are the right.
The theft card to the order cards?
The order cards, okay. Right, yeah. And at the start of the game, everybody's going to have one of each of these cards, and you can only ever use each of these powers once in the game. And once you spend that card, okay. You're done. You can never do that thing again. So the game ends, as I said before, when you get all three of the cards in your order in the open holding area, and then right. you basically press your panic button, and your bad guy's crew rolls in and right. steals everything, and you win.
That sounds cool.
And that's the game.
I think one of the hardest things could be balancing to make sure that it's not impossible to get
it's not too crazy.
Out there,
yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's my biggest concern.
But it's also
concern.
Not too easy, you know.
Yeah, that's my biggest concern.
But, no, I mean, other than that, that sounds legit. That would be, and that might not be a problem. I mean,
you'd
have to see.
It's one of those games where I think I would just have to put it together and see what happens.
Right.
You know?
No, that sounds like fun.
I'm not even sure how to.
I love the idea of the 13 envelopes. I think that's cool.
Yeah, I think that's fun. Yeah. And envelopes are not a common component used in that way. Like, I can't think of other games that use envelopes apart from Clue, you know?
No, I like it.
Yeah. So I thought that was a fun. I mean, that watching that show and thinking about that 13 vaults. Man, that's cool. I think that's cool.
I like that.
So yeah, Fort Knox is what
Sweet.
I'm calling it, but
I like
or 13 vaults, robbing Fort Knox,
something like that. Yeah.
Something like that.
13 okay. vaults, man. That's a good name.
It's a good name.
So I think that's all we have.
Okay.
We have
yeah.
Questions. So
no questions.
Don't forget to enter the contest.
Yes.
Contest ends at the end of the month.
Yes. This is your last week right now to get your contest entry in for a free copy of Penny Press.
Remember, 31st of May.
31st of May. Get it in by then. Send us your crazy, silly, game-themed newspaper story headline. We'll pick our favorite in June, and the winner will get a free copy of Penny Press. This is your last chance. The next episode, we won't be announcing a winner, but the next episode, it'll be too late.
Right.
It's going to be too late.
So we'll probably do a bonus episode to announce the winner so that we don't have to be married to the cycle of getting out there in time. So,
probably.
And that way we can get the guys back on with us. Yeah, so,
right.
Cool. So,
get it in there. And that's all.
Thanks for sticking with us tonight, guys, with our random topics.
Thanks a lot.
We've been told you like our random topics, so hopefully that is true.
Yeah, we've been kind of getting a little loose on you the last few weeks. Hope that's okay. So if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email to buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at podcastbtg. Jason is at J.A. Slingerland, and I am at poorly_designed. Like us on Facebook. 5-star review on iTunes. Call or Google voice number 770-TEL-BTG, and listen to our stupid show every week. And keep on listening. Keep on, keep on.
Keep on keeping on.
Good night.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios. All of the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are property of the Building the Game podcast. Next time on Building the Game.
From work today.
I don't understand why my phone's buzzing, dude. It's way down here.
Yeah, well, it's the worst. How about you just turn it off?
I can't turn my phone off.
Why not?
It is impossible for me to be disconnected from the world like that.
That's kind of sad.
I know, but it's okay. It's the life that I live. I get super stressed out if I don't have a phone signal.
Man.
It really bothers me.
I don't understand.
I don't understand how I lived in a world.
I don't either.
Where there were no phone signals.
How did you survive?